I gave my first presentation in person for a very long time last week.
What event was it?
Monkey Gras. Although someone said monkey grass at the event and was corrected, and I was glad because I said monkey grass to myself once or twice. It's M-O-N-K-I-G-R-A-S.
And what is a monkey gras?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. So there's a guy called James Governor, and he works at a company called Red Monk, who are like a company that does consulting and thought leadership and, you know, technical consulting and stuff like that. And I have heard of Monkey Gras from our good friend Laura Cowan, ex-Ubuntu podcast presenter. And I think she's been at some point, and I've heard of it from other people, and I've seen it mentioned online, but I've never been. And as part of something I was tasked with doing at work, it was suggested that I give some talks. And so I went crazy and submitted a bunch of talks to a load of different conferences, many of which I've never been to, for, you know, the lols, and see if I get in. And I got in, which was a kind of surprise. The theme was all about craft this year, and it was kind of alluding to the whole AI, LLM stuff, and how do we retain the craft of software engineering and software development. And talks were aimed to be themed around that. And it was held in Shoreditch in London, and it was, I think it's called the Tab. It's next to a Tabernacle Church, or it is a church. I'm not quite sure, but it's a community center churchy thing. And it was really well put together. It was a bit manic at times, and the schedule was all over the place. But everyone seemed to think, yeah, that's normal. That's what happens at this event. And so you just suck it up. Like the fact that, you know, we were overrunning by an hour, you know, midway through the first day was, it was like, yeah, that's all right. That's fine. Which was quite nice in a way. You know, I was a bit tense because my talk got scheduled for late on the first day, the very last talk of the first day. It's a 2-day event. And I was getting a little bit stressed because as the day went on, my talk was getting less and less likely to happen because it was getting pushed back. And we got to the very end of the day and everyone was a bit done for the end of the day. And there were still two talks left, someone else's and mine. And James got up in front of everyone and he said, I think you've all had enough, but what should we do? Should we try and cram these two in next week or tomorrow? Or do you want to do both of them now? And he said, okay, should we just do one of them now? And everyone was like, yeah, okay. Because everyone was a bit tired by this point. And he then said, Where's Alan? And I put my hand up and he goes, can you do yours tomorrow? I went, of course. And he went, right, okay, we'll do one now and yours tomorrow. I was like, okay. And I think that's how it works. You just got to be flexible and go with it, and it's fine. And there were some people I recognized there, a few people, DevRel people and community people and people I've heard of but never met. It was quite a set of people who've clearly, a lot of them have known each other for a long while. And I was new to this, but I was new to this event, having already met most of the people there, or many of the people there. And it was that helped that. Make it a pleasant, friendly event.
How many attendees were there?
That is a good question, and I don't know. A couple of hundred or so, okay. I think. Well, not huge. It's small and perfectly formed, I think. And the talks were varying, and I was kind of surprised that AI featured more than I thought it would. Because in the kind of spec for the event and the spiel that went along with it that invited you to do submit a talk kind of alluded to the fact that we were going to talk about, you know, the engineer and, you know, almost fighting against this new technology kind of thing. So my talk that I submitted was called The Luddites Were Right and Using Resistance to Fight Against Technological Change, or something like that. Was the title of my talk. And I wrote a synopsis, never thinking that it would get accepted. And when it was accepted, I was like, oh, God, I've got to actually write this now. Because I made it up on the spot, and it was not one I had written. Anyway, I wrote the talk and I was still editing it up until like 5 minutes before I gave it. I was fiddling it.
Just as well you got bumped to the second day.
Yes, very much so. And after the second talk on the second day, James just came over to me and he goes, do you want to go up next? I was like, yeah, okay. And so I just went up there and plugged my laptop in and started talking. And I only had 20 minutes to do this thing, which could probably have been 30 to 40. So I skipped a couple of slides, which was fine. But what I did to counteract that is I put the slides online, and there will be a link in the show notes to the presentation. And the interesting thing for this show, I think, is I used MARP. Thank you, Mark, for mentioning MARP in a previous episode. I used that to create the slides. And oh my gosh, it was wonderful. I really enjoyed using MARP to create slides. And the slides turned out okay. They're quite basic, mostly just a couple of words and one image, or an image in the background and some words over the top. But I was able to use some of the features of MARP to blur the image or desaturate the image, just using CSS, in order to make sure that people weren't too focused on the image, because some of the images had a lot of text on them. They were like a screenshot of a blog post or something. And I wanted to blur it so that people didn't try and read the blog post while I'm talking.
Yeah.
So I used, you know, various methods to do that, and it turned out okay. I had a few people afterwards tell me that it was a great talk and they really enjoyed it and it was their favorite, or, you know, lots of positive feedback. So I was very pleased, even though internally I thought, oh my God, I completely messed that up, as I always feel after every talk.
That's standard operating procedure.
Yes. In fact, today I'm at a completely different event and some of the people who were there were here at the event I went to today, and they said, oh, I was there last week. I really enjoyed your talk. I was like, oh my gosh, how did anyone enjoy that? It was a mess. What was going on?
Remember, only you know how it was supposed to go. As far as everyone else knows, it's going perfectly.
Yeah.
Just don't give the game away.
Yeah well, I'm giving the game away here. Anyway, I did say right at the start, everything I'm intending to say is in the notes. And so all the slides might look semi-blank, but every word I'm intending to say is in the notes, presenter notes, which are here, and here's the link. So yeah, popey.com/monkeygra2025 is where you'll find the notes. I haven't shared the source file, but I guess I could put that on GitHub or something. That's probably easy enough.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed Monkey Gra. I was quite pleased I gave a talk, and I was very pleased that some people enjoyed it.
That's terrific. Did you find that using MARP de-stressed the process of creating slides versus using traditional tools?
Yes, and the two things I found really good about MARP was adding an image was just copying and pasting a single line and just changing the, you know, the name of the file or whatever. I could go and get files from Unsplash or images that I knew I wanted, or take screenshots and just dump them in the directory with the MARP file, the markdown MARP file, and just add one line, and then boom, the image appeared on the screen and I could squish it up so I could have like 40% image on the left-hand side and then the rest of the 60% have a few big words on it to like go along with the picture. And that's what I did. And I alternated the image to either be on the left or the right of the screen to like mix it up a little bit. But yeah, it was good fun. I really enjoyed it and I was quite pleased. Got a bit of audience interaction and people seemed to like it. So yeah, I was quite happy and very pleased that MARP turned out to be just as good as Mark said. I used VS Code to edit it, and there is a MARP preview. So while I'm editing on the left-hand side of the screen in VS Code, on the right-hand side, I can see the slides appearing. And as I'm editing, it's just updating dynamically. It's just a brilliant way to do it.
I have been continuing to build my bookshelf buddy.
Aha, is this the name of your project to do NFC audio playback?
Yes, sort of, although it's not doing NFC yet.
Right.
But yeah, this was the project I talked about on the last episode, which didn't have a name yet, for being basically an appliance that acts as a client for Audio Bookshelf. I've decided to christen it Bookshelf Buddy.
Nice. And have you registered the domain and got the trademark and all that kind of stuff? At least get a Git repo or something.
Yeah, I should probably do that before this episode is published. But yeah, I've basically been taking where I got to last episode and refining it to the point where I think the software side of it is in a sort of minimum viable product state, where it kind of does the basic things it needs to do, because before I had it, it would basically look at a certain place on the file system and keep polling it. And if there was a file there, it would then read that and play the URL, which is fine, but it makes it a bit inflexible if you're trying to run this on different devices, which you might be plugging in different things. So what I've done instead is use the Go library called FSNotify, which uses on Linux iNotify to monitor file system events. And I have it watch the /media/username directory for the current user. And that means that whenever you plug in a USB stick or an SD card, for example, it says, hello, something's appeared. And then it can look and see if there's one of my bookshelf buddy files in there and then read it and play.
That works on a desktop where there are settings that auto mount USB sticks. What does that, how does that work on a, I don't know, is it going to be a Raspberry Pi or something? Will that also mount or not?
I don't know yet.
Oh, that's a problem for future Mark.
Exactly. This is, you know, what's the basic, all of the sort of basic plumbing and functionality it needs to be able to have. And then once I'm actually working out, you know, I've got some hardware to prototype it on, I can work out the specifics. So, you know, at the moment you interact with it with keyboard keys, but that's not going to be, you're not going to plug a keyboard in and have that sitting on your bedside table.
Why not? Model M plugged into a PS2 port on the back.
I've used FSNotify on the Raspberry Pi to do something similar to what you're doing. So I know it works on the Raspberry Pi. In my case, it was looking at a settings file for one application and seeing when it had been changed in order to trigger an interaction, an event for another application.
So yeah, this does two things. It watches, so you plug something in, it sees if there's a file there and then it starts playing. The other thing it does is then watches it being removed again and then it stops playing. And that means that if you plug in two things which have a bookshelf buddy file on, it won't try and play the second one while it's already playing the first one. It'll wait until the first one's removed and then stop and then wait for something to get plugged in again. So that was the first thing I wanted to do. The second thing was I was looking through my library and realized that not all of my audiobooks are quite the same. Some of them are one big file with chapter markers in, but some of them are a load of separate files, one for each chapter. And I needed to be able to support both and have the sort of skip forward and skip back button work in both cases. So I delved into the documentation for libvlc, which is doing the playback, and found that it actually supports something called a list player, where you can create a list of media files and then go back and forward through them. And this works actually whether you've got one or whether you've got lots. You can just add one to the list and play that, or you can add all of them to the list. And then within that, if you've one of them's got chapters, you can sort of dig in and say, does the current thing that's playing have chapters? If it does, try and go forwards. If not, then just skip to the next thing in the list. So that was another success.
Will there be a feature for it to remember how far it got through a particular book so that if you unplug and then replug, it carries on where it left off?
It's funny you should mention that. Because that is the other thing which I was working on. So Audio Bookshelf itself already does this. If you're playing in Audio Bookshelf, either in the web or on a client on your phone, it will remember, and then the other clients can see where you got up to with that book and pick up playback from there. And it took me a while to find it, but the Audio Bookshelf API does provide you with a media progress interface for each book for your user, which will give you the current playback position for that book. Yes, this is a bit tricky for those audiobooks which have multiple files, because what it does is it gives you the number of seconds from the start of the book. So I had to write a bit of an algorithm to say, right, take off the amount of time from this file, and is it in the next file? If not, take off the amount of time from that and keep going until you've got less than the duration of the current file, and then go that much forward in that file and start playing from there. But it did actually work. I started playing and skipped through in Audio Bookshelf on the web, and then I stopped playing, and then I put that same book in my Bookshelf Buddy program, and when it started playing, it picked up from the same spot.
Awesome. Nice.
Yes.
I was fully expecting you to say, no, I'm not doing that. That's too hard.
No.
But actually, the fact that there's an API for it helps a lot.
Yeah. There's, I mean, for me, this is one of the key functions of the Auto Player, that it does this, that, you know, my daughter can stick a card in that she was listening to yesterday and it will keep playing from the same place. And I don't have to then wind through and try and find out where it was. The next challenge for me is going to be making it so that it reports back to Audio Bookshelf where it got up to. So I think if you're in its own client, it polls kind of every 10, 15 seconds or so and says, here's my current position, and then it will store that. I think that libVLC lets you, like, it has like events that say, you know, playback has progressed a bit. And so I'd be able to use those events to then trigger a message to Audio Bookshelf. And it also has, Audio Bookshelf also has the concept of like playback sessions. So when you start playing, you can say to it, I'm playing now, and you can have offline sessions as well. But I'll come back to that later. Maybe if I come up with something battery powered in the future, we might need to go offline.
I was thinking, would it be more efficient to only send the current status when the FS Notify thing has triggered that you've taken the USB key out?
I did consider that, yes. Like, yeah, just say, right, you stopped, save that position. But that assumes that you always have a graceful shutdown.
Yeah, you want a checkpoint periodically, don't you? Yeah,
exactly.
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and also, you know, you want a little bit of a buffer there, because if you stop listening to something and resume the next day, you don't want it on the second. You want it maybe 10 seconds previous or something.
Possibly, yes. Yeah, you want to hear back sort of what just happened so you remember where you were. So, yes, that is the next thing which I'm looking at, which I think once that's done, that will be my sort of MVP for this. And then I'm going to start looking at the other areas, like how do you generate these files? I worked out what I need the file to have is the address of the server, the ID of the book that it's going to play, and your API key. Those are the three bits you need. I did try just having a URL, but then I found I was trying to break up the URL to reuse those tokens for other things. So it made sense if all of the requests that I'm making to Audio Bookshelf need those three bits of data, and then the rest are just different fragments of the URL scheme for the API.
Is Audio Bookshelf something that can support plugins or extensions in some way? I mean, your token creator, could that be a feature of Audio Bookshelf to sort of click on the book and say, make me a token for this book?
I was wondering that. That was going to be my next port of call to look into whether it's pluggable. I'm not sure whether it would be appropriate to make this a sort of upstream contribution, because it's just like, here, yeah, add a button to your product to support my weird thing.
I have to say, I'm a little bit worried about you putting the API key on the USB keys.
Yes, so I've thought about this as well, and I might have some way of, you create a special one of these for pairing, and that transfers the key, and then the books don't have the key, they just have, and then that's stored on the device. I have thought about that for the future as a possible way of keeping it a bit safer.
Or double Rot 13, that will do you just fine.
So, yes, I have also had a bit of feedback from the last episode, a couple of people who were interested in this and possibly interested in getting involved. And also someone who pointed me to an article on Hackaday where someone had made one of these for playing music, which is played locally from the device as opposed to being streamed from a server. But it does prove the sort of hardware concept that it's, you know, it's based on like an ESP32 board.
Oh, wow.
Oh, an ESP32. Oh, nice. Wow.
Yeah. And then it's a little box with a speaker and an RFID reader. So, you know, that's plausible, certainly.
I did go rummaging through my box of Raspberry Pi bits, and I found a device that you might be interested in that I have assembled the hardware, but I've never used it. And it is a rather thick, but it is a Raspberry Pi powered tablet. So it's a self-contained unit with a touchscreen, and it's got additional USB ports because it goes through an integrated hub. So that could be an interesting device for you to prototype with as well.
Yes. Yeah. I imagine I'm going to be trying all sorts of things to see what actually works.
I have some GUI love that helps close the parity gap between the mainstream operating systems and the Linux desktop.
The mainstream operating system? You mean iOS and Android?
Oh, damn it.
Gotcha.
The other minority desktop operating systems, such as Windows and Mac OS.
Okay.
I notice quite often now, when I watch like hardware reviews for CPUs and GPUs, they're typically benchmarked on Windows to give you some appreciation for what the performance characteristics of these different devices are. And for some time now, I've noticed that when they bring up the Windows sort of system monitor utility, among the various things it reports, it includes GPU utilization as part of the just general system overview. And we've talked in previous podcasts about specific tools that you can use to just look at GPU resources. But the system monitoring tools I've used on the desktop before are a bit crude. They seem a bit blunt in the modern day because they have a process list, which is everything from the kernel broken down by every child device. So they're very verbose and they don't have GPU information and they don't have some of the other things that represent the general behavior of the computer.
And I bet you also can't play Doom on each CPU being one pixel, right?
Probably not. So I went off looking for a sort of a modern system monitor type application, and I found one called Resources. And it's a GTK4 / GNOME application. And the tagline is quite simply, keep an eye on system resources. And this has hit the spot perfectly for me. I know we've talked about the various top likes that exist and using some of the terminal-based applications, but I also do like a bit of GUI love on the desktop. And Resources is terrific. It's got just the right amount of configuration, so there's not an overwhelming array of options, but the options that exist are just the right ones to sort of change the experience to suit what you want to see. The defaults are sensible. For example, it doesn't report on any virtual drives or loopback devices or virtual network interfaces by default. So you kind of just get a very obvious view of your machine.
I like that it breaks down the applications rather than, like you said, other things where there's like every single process and thread is a thing. With this, it's got like an icon for Firefox and an icon for, you know, the VPN client, an icon for Sync thing or whatever. They're each like are atomic things that I recognize that I can see a high percentage for. I really like that. That's really nice.
This was the first thing that I thought, ooh, somebody's really paid attention to how they're presenting this, because it has, as you say, this apps view, which is just the leaf node application. So it's your browser, your IDE, your music player, your file manager, you know, those messaging clients, but not all of the extra processes, just those top level things, including that you can turn on is obviously the CPU and memory that each of those applications is using and the GPU utilization of those applications, which is rather nice because increasingly there are a number of desktop applications that use different facilities of the GPU. And one of the options you can turn on in Resources is not just the general GPU utilization, but the video and encode utilization as well. So if you've got something like OBS running or a web browser watching streaming video, you can actually see where the offload is happening to your video hardware to accelerate those various things. And I really like that.
That's pretty cool. Does it also show like CUDA stuff? Like if I had a desktop LLM thing running, would I see it spike when I ask it questions?
Yes, that comes under the GPU utilization. So if you were running something like Misty, which is a desktop LLM runner, or there's another one called Yan, then yes, as you fire up those local LLMs, you would see, one, the GPU memory utilization climb as it loads the model. And then as you start to issue prompts, you would see the utilization on the GPU whilst it responds to the queries.
Nice. Next question. This is the most important question. Does the application itself consume tons of CPU in order to draw it?
It claims not to. And I knew you were going to ask this question. So I even went and looked in the source code to see if it was deliberately like isolating itself in any way. And it doesn't appear to be. So no, it doesn't use very much resources of its own in order to present and keep track of things. Although one of the things I did do is, I think the default is to display an update every second, and I don't need that kind of fidelity, so I changed it to every 2 seconds. So we've talked about the GPU integration, and that's the key piece here, is that you can see that GPU utilization just alongside each process, because in addition to the leaf node applications, which I really like, there is also a processes view where you can see absolutely everything like you would, you know, in a traditional top type thing of everything. But again, you can expose the GPU utilization alongside each of those processes, which is sometimes interesting if you've got a threaded application and it's a particular thread that may be utilizing particular features. So having said how much I like that integrated GPU metric, I think the one thing that resources could add that would kind of complete it is you get a system overview for the network utilization, but you can't do a bandwidth style network utilization per process. And I think being able to see the network metrics on a process level or an application level would be seriously terrific.
Does it do disk usage as well per process or per application?
Yes, it does. Not storage consumed by,
no,
but I.O. throughput.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, because that's often something that's handy to see, like, what is it that's thrashing my disk?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's very complete. It's got all of the usual things I'd expect to find, but it's just beautifully presented, just enough options to make it your own. And that GPU utilization being baked in and carefully integrated, I really, really like. So it's resources. We'll have a link in the show notes. And if you're on a GTK or GNOME desktop, it's something worth checking out. It's published on Flatpak, and you'll find it in the repositories of most current distributions.